Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I don't need these headphones, where I run through the current version of my Sunday sermon, and this draft will be rougher than usual. I took a couple days off this week. I often do that. My wife, her spring break is the same as Holy Week, which makes no sense in the state of California, but that's the way it goes, and so we took a couple days and went out to the desert, which was just wonderful, but it makes this a little rough, and I'll probably keep working on this sermon tomorrow, but here's a really rough draft for Sunday. And as earlier this week I posted, you've been getting some reruns, I'm going to post some of the sermons leading up to Easter. I thought the series has gone well. But if you're curious about how it goes Sunday morning, you can always come to the tune in of the TV language. You can always go to the Living Stones Christian Reformed Church channel on YouTube, and we'll live stream it. Rick's going to be playing with a new mic, so we'll see if that improves the sound, or maybe there won't be any sound at all. You never really quite know how it's going to go. Pastorally, you hear this question a lot. How could God let that happen? Or how could God let this happen to me? Or God would never let that happen? Or why would God let this happen to me? And endless permutations of that question. Some around Living Stones will recognize this face, Dottie Harrington. She's no longer with us, but she eventually became a deacon. She was one of these women that brought a lot of her friends to church, and she never had much toleration for this question, which was interesting. She was a quite remarkable woman in many respects. And when someone would say that, she would say, "Why me? Why not me?" And she sort of didn't have much patience for the what felt to her like sort of self-pity. She didn't tolerate that. She was a no-nonsense kind of woman. Now, the idea that any of us might be excluded from the common fate of humanity is, she had a point, really more remarkable. If you just look around, you begin to realize that everyone suffers, and some people suffer horribly. And the seeming accounts for it, sometimes people suffer from their own foolishness or lack of wisdom. But sometimes, quite remarkably, good and wise people suffer horribly. And that's the way we see life happen in this world. So given what we know about this life, the whole question, why would God let this happen to me, bears a little bit of examination. Ancient pagans didn't ask this question like we do. They had far lower expectations. They believed life was short, painful, and chaotic, and the best that you could do was somehow try to manipulate the spiritual powers or the gods or good fortune or whatever to get the best that you could out of life. Odysseus from Homer's The Odyssey is kind of the prototypical wise man in finding one way or another to work or cheat the gods to get what he'd want out of life. Down through the ages, what has impacted our culture far more is, of course, the Bible, and especially the Exodus, where Moses leads the children of Israel out of Egypt. And Moses is told to tell the children of Egypt, "You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, how I carried you out on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." Now right there you begin to get a sense of, well, if we do everything right, then everything will be great. And you can read the end of the book of Deuteronomy, where they have this chapter of covenant curses if you fail the covenant, and chapter of covenant blessings if you keep the covenant. Now, things didn't go so well. Andrew Clavin, who is an author, and he's also by ethnicity a Jew, but by profession a Christian, later in life. He and his brother would talk about the calamity of the Jews and say, and his brother told him once, the reason the Jews are God's chosen people was because no one would volunteer. And it's another common joke, you know, why doesn't he choose someone else in terms of all the suffering and calamity that, of course, the children of Israel have over the years endured? But McLavin makes in one particular video, he makes a point, and he says something about as succinctly as I've ever heard it said about biblical Israel. They are the theater in which God plays out his relationship to humankind. And in many ways, if you want to understand the Bible, that's how. Biblical Israel is the theater in which God plays out his relationship with humankind. Now, we're going to talk a lot about temple in this sermon. We've been talking about the temple for the last few weeks in the sermons at Living Stones. The stage gets set really in Genesis 1, because as John Walton, who's a Christian Old Testament scholar, notes, that Genesis 1 is a temple text. Ancient people reading that text would quickly recognize that here in Genesis 1, God is setting up habitable order, and temples are key to that understanding in the ancient world. Temples were microcosms of the whole world, and so that very compact poem of 7 days in Genesis 1 is a temple text where God sets up a functioning world. And in Genesis 2, it's sort of like the garden to the temple. You can see the temple of Versailles and the garden of the temple of Versailles. The man and the woman are there in the garden. Now, royal ancient gardens would have animals and all kinds of things. And so here you have the ancient garden, and the man and the woman are there to tend the garden. But of course, in Genesis 3, something pretty significant happens. The woman is looking at the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and the serpent comes along and suggests, why has God said you can't eat from this tree? Why would God withhold the fruit of this obviously very desirable tree from you? And the serpent says, I'll tell you why. It's because he doesn't want the best for you. And he knows that the day that you eat this fruit, you won't die, but you'll be like God, and you'll know good and evil. Now, this biblical knowing is a very rich knowing. If you read it in the King James, you know, as a kid, you would read, and Adam knew his wife Eve, and she conceived, and suddenly that biblical knowing is a very rich sort of knowing. And so you will know good and evil. And, well, of course, they take from the tree. And every time we cry out now, how could God let this happen? It's downstream from that. And our cry testifies to the fact that we are now knowing evil in a way we wish we never did. Now, the story of the Bible is a long history of a relationship between God and his people. And in some ways, it's God trying to undo what happens with Adam and Eve, the man and the woman in the garden. And you find God choosing Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You find God rescuing Israel from Egypt. You find God calling Israel into covenant. God was looking for a way for a holy God to redeem, restore, and renew and live with a people who had rebelled against him and, in fact, have a habit of rebelling. The Heidelberg Catechism says, I have a natural tendency to hate God and my neighbor. I'm going to add that to the slide. And so what we see in the story of Israel is these temples are around. And so, of course, the first, they have the tabernacle, which was this portable temple. Then finally, David's son Solomon builds this glorious temple in Jerusalem. And Jerusalem and the temple are pretty much synonymous. Then as things continue to devolve between God and Israel, some Israelites, and this is testified to in the book of Jeremiah, begin to say, well, God won't let bad things happen to the temple, not like they happened to the northern kingdom who didn't have the temple. God won't let bad things happen to his temple. We can pretty much do whatever we want because we sort of have God's arm twisted behind his back. We have the temple of the Lord. And I always tell people, don't play chicken with God. You really don't want to pick that fight because you can't manipulate God by imagining he won't sacrifice something enormously precious to himself in order to achieve what he wants to achieve. Don't play chicken with God. Don't play poker with God. You don't want to try and bluff him. The Babylonians come and destroy the temple. Now a second temple, another temple gets rebuilt under the Persians, and the temple gets renovated by Herod the Great. We talked about that over the last couple of weeks, and that is the temple, in fact, that Jesus is there, at the time Jesus is there. But the temple wasn't just a representation. As we noted, that the temple is sort of a scale model, a working replica, a microcosm in which the drama of the whole, we said that biblical Israel is the theater that is used to portray God's relationship with all of humankind. And in some ways, the temple is sort of the center of this, where we participate in the world. We looked at this quote a couple weeks ago, and last week again, it's from Karen Armstrong's book about Jerusalem, and she notes that pilgrims who were going up into the temple felt a more intense mode of existence, and Josephus, one of our early witnesses to this period, noted that the entire structure of the temple was set up as sort of a microcosm of the world, sort of like Genesis 1. Josephus had been a priest. The court of the Gentiles was associated with the sea in Genesis 1, the tohu wavohu, out of which, you know, monsters come in Daniel chapter 7. And that's so sort of the chaos against the sacred order. And then you had the holy place, which is sort of represented the whole created world, the productive world, and all of its elements symbolize different things in it. Its curtains symbolize the four elements and the whole vista of the heavens. The lamps on the great candlesticks stood for the seven planets, and the 12 loaves of showbread recalled the signs of the zodiac and the 12 months of the year. And the incense altar with its 13 spices from sea and land, inhabited and uninhabited, symbolized all things that came from God and came from God and were for God. And so again, the temple is sort of this small participatory thing. Just recently on The Bachelor, Joey and Kelsey found love. But it was interesting because, of course, The Bachelor has its own rituals that it begins with, and it begins with the women getting out of the limousine, and they usually have some little trick or saying or something that would maybe help the bachelor remember them. And as he's sifting through the 30 women who are supposedly wanting to be his bride, well, Kelsey's from New Orleans, and she comes with a voodoo doll. Now let's not get too excited about that, but I use this as an illustration because, of course, the little doll is supposed to represent the bigger man, and just like the temple is supposed to represent the bigger creation. Now, of course, in movies, you stick pins in voodoo dolls in order to hurt the person. In this case, she sort of embraced the voodoo doll and kissed the voodoo doll and hoped that if she was nice to the voodoo doll, then, you know, Big Joey, then the relationship would work. And, well, we certainly wish them well. Track record for bachelors and their love interests seldom work so well, but hope it works out for you too. Last week, we saw some of this play out in Palm Sunday, where Jesus curses the fig tree, and Jesus is talking about how the temple has failed to fulfill its divine task. Jesus announces the destruction of Herod's temple, and Jesus points to a new house of God, not made of stone or gold, not made with human hands, but made up of living stones following the living stone. And we talked about that last week, and you can read that in 1 Peter 2. A new temple to be a house of prayer for all nations. Now they took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, and the elders and the teachers of the law came together. And Peter followed him at a distance right into the courtyard of the high priest. There he sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they did not find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements didn't agree. In other words, they're looking for some charge that they could bring against Jesus that would sort of pass muster, but he's really guilty of people envying him, of saying things that annoyed them and provoked them. There's no real charge they could bring against him. Then some stood and gave false testimony against him. We heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with human hands, and in 3 days will build up another not made with hands. Now, it's very interesting the way this sort of goes, because what was Jesus saying? Why was Jesus talking about the temple? And other gospels will pick up on this. Yet even their testimony did not agree. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, why are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? I am, said Jesus. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One coming in the clouds of heaven. The high priest tore his clothes. Why do we need any more witnesses? He said. You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And they all condemned him as worthy of death. Then some began to spit at him, and they blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and said, prophesy. And the guards took him and beat him. Now, of course, there's going to be a Roman trial because they have to get Pilate to go along with it, but they do. It was 9 in the morning when they crucified him. The written note on the charge against him read, the King of the Jews. They crucified 2 rebels with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, so, you are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days? Come down from the cross and save yourself. In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. He saves others, they said, but he can't save himself. Let this Messiah, this King of Israel, come down from the cross that he may see, that we may see and believe. Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. In other words, and we've talked about this in previous weeks, they wanted some display of miraculous power by which he would best his enemies, the kinds of things we might see in a modern superhero movie where the superhero seems to be finally beaten but rises up and then vanquishes his enemies. It's not the story here. At noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. And at 3 in the afternoon, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? How could God let this happen? Father, how could you let this happen? Why have you forsaken me here on the cross? These words have echoed through the years. Jesus asked this same question that people ask all the time in a very personal way. And it's not just sort of an abstract God or a God way out there. He's asking the God he calls Father. And has again and again talked about this intimate relationship between him and his Father. And now he says, you've forsaken me. Why? Remember how in Jeremiah they couldn't use God's temple against him and his mission? Don't play chicken with God. What are the lengths that God is going to do to achieve what he wants all the way back in Israel, all the way back to the temple? Now God gives what is most precious to accomplish what is most utmost of importance. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus saw how he died, he said, surely this man was the Son of God. Why at that moment mention the temple curtain? What's the connection between Jesus and the temple? Something small, something large. But which is small and which is large? Now, we've talked in previous weeks about how when Jesus was going down to Jerusalem, everybody thought that was a bad idea, because what he probably should do and stay is stay in Galilee and raise an army. And when he goes down to Jerusalem to bring his army and make sure that, well, he gets his way when he gets down there, no disasters happen to him. But of course, Jesus has told them 3 times exactly what will happen. We are going up to Jerusalem, And the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him and flog him and kill him. It all happened. And then the last thing Jesus said each time was, 3 days later he will rise. 3 days. That's what that testimony about the temple? Isn't that Jesus and the temple? They're connected. And again, we've noted that outside the tomb, there was no great banner and a group of willing disciples with flags and celebrations and maybe a nice meal to come out and say, "Welcome back, Jesus," this Easter Sunday morning, to have a nice little sunrise service and breakfast together. Nothing. Nothing. Who was there? When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome brought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they didn't bring goodies, donuts, and treats. They brought spices to embalm him. As they were on their way to the tomb, and they were asking each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" You got some women here, and it's a big, heavy stone. But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting at the far side, and they were alarmed. Now, pay attention to the details here, because it's written just like a person would remember it. Now, you know, is this young man an angel? There's no interpretation here. As N.T. Wright says, it's unembroidered. It's just a young man in a white robe sitting at the right side. And they're alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "Why are you looking for, Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified? He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go and tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anybody because they were afraid. This is a very reasonable story told from eyewitnesses who, they're not embroidering or embellishing this. This is exactly how it would happen if you think about the circumstance. Now, if you're reading along in your Bible, you might notice that there's sometimes a line there or a footnote there. What people have noticed for a very, very long time is that what happened quite possibly, because if this thing was written on a scroll, the end of the scroll gets a little poor treatment, and the way they end it, they said nothing to anyone because they were afraid, hardly seems like an appropriate ending. And so there have been a number of attempts to end it, and one very early attempt is probably in italics or something in your notes, because it didn't come from the original author of the Gospel of Mark. What this is probably is pretty much just kind of thoughts and reflections from very early Christians about, well, what the end of the story is and what the rest of the story is. When Jesus rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had driven 7 demons. She went and told those who had been with him and who were in mourning and weeping. When they heard that Jesus was alive and that she had seen him, they did not believe it. And again, if you read the other gospel accounts, it's sort of a mashup of all the other gospel accounts right in this one. Afterwards, Jesus appeared in different form to 2 of them while they were still walking in the country. They returned and reported it to the rest. That's the road to Emmaus. You can find in the Gospel of Luke. But they did not believe them either. Later, Jesus appeared to the 11 when they were eating. He rebuked them for their lack of faith and their stubborn refusal to believe those who had seen him after he had risen. And of course, you have Thomas and all of those stories. He said to them, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel for our creation. Whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, but whoever does not believe will be condemned." And you pretty much have the Great Commission. "And these signs will accompany those who believe. In my name they will drive out demons, they will speak in new tongues, they will pick up snakes with their hands, and they will drink deadly poison. It will not hurt them at all. They will place their hands on sick people and they'll get well." It's kind of a summary of things you have in the book of Acts. After the Lord had spoken to them, he was taken up into heaven and was sat at the right hand of God. Then disciples went out and preached everywhere, and the Lord worked with them and confirmed his word by the signs that accompanied it. Again, pretty much the book of Acts. Now, it might sound all rosy there at the end of the Gospel of Mark, but if you read the book of Acts, it's of course anything but rosy. And if you read the rest of the New Testament, there's plenty more trial to have. There's plenty more suffering that will come. And a number of weeks ago, when we talked about Jesus and the rich young ruler, you receive these things along with persecutions. These things will come. In many ways, Dottie is right. Why me? Well, why me? Why not me? Why you? Why not you? Please tell me. Yes, you are God's chosen people, but look what happens to God's chosen people. In fact, look what happens to God's chosen instrument. They are the theater in which God plays out his relationship with humankind. Now, Jesus fulfills this drama. He is tied to the temple. You can see that again and again and again in this story. Jesus identifies with the temple. Jesus is in many ways the replacement of the temple. They function in different ways as this connection between God and his creation. Now, that doesn't necessarily help you, or does it? Because you say, well, there's this suffering. Well, as you saw with the ancients and everyone, suffering is always a matter of a larger context. We do suffer, and we will suffer, and to live in this world pretty much means to suffer one way or another. But do you see your sufferings within a bigger story? Do you see your sufferings between the little and the large? Do you believe, in fact, that there is a bigger story at work? That maybe your sufferings are not pointless, but maybe, just maybe, they can and will be used in some way at some point? Do you believe there is a God who will make big risks and who will pay big costs in order to achieve something? That's what the crucifixion is about. There's nothing wrong with asking the big question. Jesus does it from the cross. But what he does, it invites us into faith. Now, the cross is always joined with the resurrection. And without the resurrection, the cross means something wholly different. Jesus' trial was not fruitless. And what he offers us is, in fact, fruit in our suffering. And the question we have is, do we want to participate in this drama? See, the ancients weren't wrong in the ubiquity of suffering. Everybody gets that. Any keen observer of this world sees that. It isn't even, it isn't easy, it isn't often seemingly fair. But all those ancients pretty much, and their heirs, became Christians. Why? Because they saw a better way in Jesus. Yes, they would suffer, but now there was meaning to their suffering. There was redemption in their suffering. Even if they couldn't see any, they believed because of Jesus that maybe, just maybe, just like at that moment Jesus is being crucified and it all looks pointless, something much bigger was happening that God could use even that costly sacrifice to achieve an even greater glory. The real question today is, these new crops of pagans who know nothing of the story, which may include you, will you find it like the ancients did?